2FM. Dave, how are you? Are you well?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good indeed. Listen, first of all, congratulations. It's a fantastic story. It really is. And one of the most important things that comes through the whole thing is the fact that you are such a fan. And when you meet the people who were your heroes, you're not overawed necessarily. You're just so damn delighted to meet them. Isn't that it?
It's true. I mean, as I was writing all of these short stories, you know, I was kind of writing them from the perspective of someone who feels like they're having an out-of-body experience every day. So it's like I'm watching these things happen to someone else. I can't believe they're actually happening to me. And I mean, there's no denying when you come face to face with someone who's either been a musical hero or just a big part of your life. Music's been such a big part of my life. When I come face to face with Little Richard, it's hard to imagine that he's real, you know, but that's one of the great things when you meet these people and they're flesh and bone, it kind of reminds you or reassures you that like, oh, life actually happened. Like, this is real. Like, this person is real.
Exactly. And that one was the weirdest one of all, because you're standing in LAX and this guy comes up and says, hey, you're Dave Grohl and you're a fan of Little Richard, aren't you? Yeah, well, I'm his son. Do you want to meet him? What?
It could. Well, here's the thing is that I always said if there was one person I would want to meet, it would be Little Richard, because to me, he was the innovator. He was the originator. We wouldn't have rock and roll the way we have and if it weren't for him. So to see him face to face, I thought, okay, like life wasn't just a dream. It was actually real.
Okay, but Dave, listen, the strange thing about this is there's so much in the book, and really I could go anecdote to anecdote. So I could go about the John Bonham seance and the law of attraction, CBGBs and the pit bull. I could go Saturday Night Live and suddenly your stick breaks. Weird Al coming in saying, can I cover Smells Like Teen Spirit, which means I've arrived. And then, like, you know, the Bridge School, the whole family idea there, meeting Bush and Obama in the White House, which everybody does that. And AC/DC out for dinner with everybody, with Paul McCartney, and then a trumpet band from New Orleans comes in, and etc. And like, I'm not even going to mention any of those things, because I want to mention lots of other stuff in the book that you have. I mean, first of all, the band Scream, when you think about it and the way you sat down to write and you really use your time so well, you could actually write a full book about that first band of yours. And that's how much stuff you have in your head, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the biggest challenge, was deciding what to write and what not to write, what to put into the book. And so it all started last year when everything shut down and the band wasn't on the road and I had nothing but time. I started this Instagram page. It was called Dave's True Stories. And that, just to have something to do. And then also, you know, to give maybe to brighten someone's day for 5 or 6 minutes in an otherwise really difficult time, like just to sort of like spread a little bit of joy. And then I thought, well, I'm going to be here a while. I might as well write a book. So I had made this list of 30 or 40 stories that I was going to write for this Instagram page. And I just handed that to the publisher. I said, there you go. Okay, you tell me what you want me to write. And they would just assign me these stories. So as I was writing them, it wasn't in any sort of chronological order. It was just as if we were like sitting together at a pub and I would tell you a story, maybe 5 or 6,000 words. But it was really difficult to decide what to put in and what not to put in, because you're right. A band like Scream, that was a really huge part of my life, really formative years that I could write an entire book about that, or an entire book about Nirvana, or an entire book about the Foo Fighters. It's funny. I was 300 pages in and I hadn't even mentioned the Foo Fighters yet. And I thought, oh God, I got to put them in or else they'll kill me. Like these are my best friends. I have to write something. So there's so much, there's no way to tell the entire story in one book, but this paints a really good picture of what it's like to be in my shoes.
Yeah, and you do get to Foo Fighters, obviously, big time, but also towards the end, you give everybody almost a full page of just what they mean to you, each individual one, or a full few paragraphs or whatever. But just going back very early, and I don't want to spend too long there too, because I want to go in the middle of everything, with everything that you're doing musically. Brady Bunch and Happy Days, we'd see them on television, and that was basically the kind of place that you grew up, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I grew up in a suburb of Washington, D.C. that was once like a rural crossroads. And then in the 60s, it was carved into these little suburban neighborhoods, just tiny lots with these tiny homes. And it was very much like white picket fence, white bread, suburban existence, which some people would consider the American dream. But because I was born with the mind of a hoodlum, you know, to me, it was like the devil's playground. And so I just found as much like mischief and trouble as I could possibly find. And I wanted to break out of that when I was young, because I had these rock and roll posters on my walls, and I'd look up at my Led Zeppelin poster, and I'd look up at my Beatles poster, I'd look up at my Sex Pistols poster, and I'd say, I think there's a whole world out there that I need to experience. And that's why eventually at 17, I decided I was just going to split Springfield, leave school, and just take rock and roll all over the world.
Yeah, when I think about it, the Ramones have a great song called Sheena is a Punk Rocker. Tracy, she was a punk rocker, wasn't she?
She was. I mean, my cousin Tracy, she lived in Chicago. And so we would drive up from Washington, D.C. to Chicago every year. It's like a 12-hour drive. They lived in this beautiful turn-of-the-century mansion that was right down the street from Lake Michigan, which is such a huge lake. It's like an ocean. So people would hang out on the beaches there. And this one year we showed up, and Tracy had become a punk rocker. And so that was the first time I was face-to-face with a punk rocker. I didn't know that it was real. I'd only seen it on television. I'd seen it on shows like Chips and Quincy. And she took me to see my first live band. So the first time I ever saw a band on stage was a punk rock band in a tiny pub. And it changed my life.
Yeah, the whole thing, I mean, you've said it before, really did change your life completely, absolutely, and just in terms of the music. You suddenly realized that you had you got on well at home, you had a good family, but at the same time, you got on a lot better with your mother than you did with your father.
I did, yeah. I mean, my parents split, I think, when I was 6 years old, maybe 7 years old. And they were total opposites. It was such a mismatch, those two. It's like my mother was a liberal public school teacher. My father was a conservative Republican speechwriter in Washington, D.C. It didn't work out. My mother raised my sister and I. I was always in contact with my father. He was always close by. But we were just, I mean, I always say, like, how far does the apple fall from the tree? Like, in my case, it rolled all the way down the hill. And I couldn't have been more upset. But he was a classically trained musician. So we both had a love of music. And later on in life, that's how we sort of reconnected and reunited. And then we became friends. As I became a man, he and I wound up being very close. And he was the one that inspired me to write, actually.
Right. But you also have shown a little bit of seeing two different people in a room where you go backstage somewhere once at some charity thing. I can't remember, whatever it was. Anyway, and you realize there's that guy there who looks pretty cool, and there's that guy there who looks absolutely wrecked. You said, I want to be the guy who looks absolutely wrecked, because I say you would celebrate the ensuing years by embracing the toll they'd taken on me. You have done that, and you're proud of it, aren't you?
I am. I mean, I think there's something to be said for not necessarily growing old gracefully, but growing old in that, like, just as some people carry tattoos with them their entire life, I have these scars and these lines and things that I look back on. I'm proud of them. And when I see myself in the mirror, I feel 27. I sure don't look 27, but I feel good about it. I feel good about the lines and the scars.
Okay, you also, with the music, just to be very quickly to go through it, you finally experienced a connection that made you feel understood, etc. The love of subversive music, as you say, the celebration of personal expression. Now, Naked Ray Gun, right, okay, and very important, the music, the violent dancing, etc. Do you still have your copy of Flammable Solid?
I do. The book, I think there's a photo of that single.
Just because of the photo of it in the book doesn't mean you still have it. I'm very impressed. That's very good.
Yeah, that one's actually mine. That was the one.
You do go on about musicians who create their own feel, as you call it, and there's an internal rhythm. And you express it that we could see that now with, say, Kurt Cobain, and I didn't know this. So when he's on the Unplugged, maybe, as you can see, his jaw is clenched, and as things move from side to side, everybody has their thing. You explained that very well, which I haven't done. Could you explain that to me now better?
Okay. So basically, when I was young, I don't know how it started, but I started playing drums with my teeth. Like, I figured out how to, like, I knew which side of the mouth was the kick drum, which side of the mouth was the snare drum. And I started kind of like working out these rhythms in my head so much that I went to the dentist once, and he backed up and he asked me, he said, do you chew a lot of ice? I said, no, I don't think so. And he said, there's this unusual amount of deterioration in your teeth. And then I said, I know how to play drums with my teeth. And I made him lean down and put his ear to my mouth, and I played drums with my teeth. But that's one of the things, is Kurt did the same thing. So when you see him playing guitar and you see his mouth moving back and forth, he's basically like, that's his metronome as he's playing.
Exactly, yeah.
He's using his mouth to do that. And I was kind of the same way. But here's the thing, is I think when you become so obsessed with music, whatever resource you have to make it, whether you have an instrument or not, it just kind of takes over. you know, and it becomes a part of you. So whether you're just like tapping on a desk, you're playing drums with your teeth, you're learning to play drums on pillows, you've got a guitar with two strings, whatever it takes to make music, you're going to do that.
Yeah. By the way, we are talking to Dave Grohl, of course. Here's music from Foo Fighters. There you go. That's a track from Foo Fighters, of course. And Dave Grohl is here. And the book, by the way, it's just great. It's fantastic the way the whole story goes. But there's little bits that, like, for instance, when you talk about drumming and John Bonham, you mentioned something about the fact that, you know, it's not the how he did something. It's the why. You're getting into the mind of the way he plays more than just all the stuff we usually talk about.
Yeah. Oh, but I mean, you know, I'm not much of a technical player. I taught myself how to play guitar and drums. So I'm never really concerned with that kind of stuff. I have a great appreciation for drummers that are rudimentally trained or taught and play, you know, that can really play. But for me, it's more like these days, if I hear a song that I enjoy, or if I hear there's a new band, I'll watch their interviews before I even listen to the music. Because I want to hear their voice. I want to know what kind of person they are. I want to hear. And then when I listen to the music, I have a deeper understanding of what it's all about. But I'm just kind of that way. And, you know, there's something to be said for feel, which is everybody's individual take on music. You can write a piece of music, put it on a chart, have three different musicians play the same piece of music, and it'll sound different. Each musician, no two musicians play the same. And it has to do with your personality, as it's in your hands, it's in your heart. And I really love that about music, because that's where the human element comes out that way. You can tell the type of person by what they're playing and how they're playing it.
Exactly. Now, the part in the book where, like, the whole thing gets out of hand, the whole thing becomes too big, and you're in a band called Nirvana, and you're selling 300,000 copies a day, and you knock Michael Jackson off the top of the charts. And you have a thing where there's one sentence where you talk about it just in terms of the effect it all had. And it's just about the fact that, you know, suddenly you had a gold record. And I'm thinking, what are you on about? A gold record is just a byproduct of what happened. Suddenly it became the biggest damn thing to happen in music in the 90s. Surely that's bigger than just a gold record.
Well, you have to understand, at the time when that was happening, we were still touring
in our van, with our
trailer full of equipment. We were still loading our own gear on stage and plugging in and playing. And so the world was changing around us, but within our little bubble, everything felt completely the same. And it wasn't until much later that we realized what had happened. You know, in our little world, I was still living with my friend in a back room of his house. I had a futon and a lamp, and, like, my life hadn't changed. So people would tell me these things like, oh, you just knocked Michael Jackson off the charts. And it was hard to believe, you know. Again, it felt like it was happening to someone else, not me.
Oh, yeah, no. But I mean, when you go back to September 90 and the whole of that thing there, you mentioned Kurt's ever-evolving sense of melody. Did you notice that he was suddenly churning out this melodious, tough music?
Yeah, well, you know, there was an album before Nevermind.
Oh, yeah, Bleach.
Yeah, Bleach. So the drummer of Bleach was this guy, Chad Channing. He was great. And on that record, you know, it's got this really dissonant, heavy, sort of noisy sound to it. But there was this one song called About a Girl. And it really stood out in all of that, because you've got this dissonant, like, distorted, almost punk rock sound. And then you've got a song in the middle that sounds like it could have been written by Lennon and McCartney. It was almost like a Beatles track. You thought, wow, they're capable of doing that. And then you sort of put those two things together, and that's what the songs from Nevermind. We would write a song, at least a song a week, or at least a song every few days. We would rehearse in this barn, and then after rehearsal, we'd go back to the apartment that Kurt and I lived in. He'd go in his room, I'd sleep on the couch, and he would write all night. And then we'd go to the barn the next day, and there'd be another song. He was so prolific. He really was. And he had such a beautiful sense of simplistic harmony and melody that it was, everything he wrote was so catchy, and his lyrics were so good. I mean, he really was such an incredible songwriter that, you know, unfortunately, we only have a few albums to hear what he had to offer. But
and when, when you noticed a different kind of fan coming, did you think, wait a minute now, there are certain rules of being in the kind of punk world and I'm happy in that world and what I don't want these, or was it, this is really exciting, new doors are opening here and yeah, I'm prepared to go, if you like, sorry to use it with a big capital M, mainstream, let's see what happens.
No, it was, I mean, it was a little bit of both, because I think that, you know, I think that Kurt, part of Kurt wanted to be the biggest band in the world. I mean, I'd heard him say it before, and I always thought he was kind of kidding. But then there was that other part where, you know, we grew up in this punk rock scene, and you know, we were sort of conditioned to reject all corporate structure and the music industry and things. But ultimately, it's like, what do you do when the world starts singing your songs? I mean, do you turn it off or do you share it? And it's complicated. Like, you wind up at this crossroads. It becomes an ethical dilemma. And you have to be really careful because, you know, you either have to jump on or it's going to roll over you. You just have to figure out how to navigate. It's not easy. And you have to remember, we were kids at the time. We were 22, 23 years old. Yeah.
But also, when you do, you did jump on and you were careful and you did it right. Now, unfortunately, your lead singer didn't, because it just became different. Because when the album came out, September 24, 91, you mentioned in the book, then you have a whole sentence. It's brilliant. It's just a, and then the video came out. And the video just changed. I mean, like, the brilliant story of you're watching 120 minutes on MTV. And in fact, all the bands you mentioned that have been on, like, you're watching that, come on. There's Morrissey, there's Wonder Stuff, there's I don't know, Transvision, Vamp, for God's sake, English bands. And then the thing comes on. And just, you're watching yourself on MTV. I didn't realize that at that stage that would have meant so much to you, in that, had you not been on, was there nothing on Bleach on 120 hours? Or were you not a bit used to that, no?
No, I mean, at the time, you know, We had a friend that worked at MTV, a girl named Amy Finnerty. And she was, after we made the Teen Spirit video, she brought it to the people at the network. She said, you should play this. And they're like, nah, we're not going to play this. She's like, no, you should play this. People will like this. And they're like, nah, we can't show that. So when they first started showing it, they would only show it like past midnight. Because it's a bunch of kids burning down a gymnasium in high school. And it really caught on. And they started playing it. And I think that was the moment that everything changed, because I think it gave some sort of like visual where you could see our aesthetic or what we represented, and that connected to millions and millions of kids around the world, and things changed overnight like that. It was very quick.
Okay, well, let's give it a blast. Here it is. There you go. I think you know that one. All right. We're talking to Dave Grohl here, and his book, his story, is just a fantastic story. So I just want to stay there for a little bit before I get to Foo Fighters, which is this. Like, you know, there was a musical revolution going on. You had the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Nirvana, and Pearl Jam, New Year's Eve, 1991. It was like a completely new, different thing. Here's the sentence, actually. In just 40 days, we had gone from three disheveled young men with nothing to lose to three disheveled young men with a gold record and an awful lot more, I would have thought. I mean, there's one example of Dallas, a gig in Dallas. It's actually, you're laughing. I wouldn't like to have been in the band of that gig. I mean, that's how frightening it got, isn't it?
I mean, it got to the point where whenever I'd sit down at the drum stool, the first thing I would do would be to look for the exit, because I knew if there's a riot, I'm going to have to get out of here. I mean, it got to
nightly.
It was nuts. Well, that night in Dallas, it actually turned into, it got a little dark. But everywhere we went, like the next show, a week before, the crowd rushed the stage and trashed the equipment and we all had to run out of the club. It got to be that chaotic. And there was something that was really exciting, because we were watching this revolution happen in front of us. But there was a part of you that just felt like your back was up against the wall and you had 600 or 700 people facing you like, come on, let's start the revolution, you know. So it was nuts.
OK, but look, just finally on that, because I do want to ask one last question. Finally on that, like, you know, you go around and some people say, hey, I know you, you're Dave Navarro. But like for Kurt, it was a life sentence. Isn't that it? It was just different.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as the drummer of the band, I remained relatively anonymous, you know, but Kurt really carried the weight of the band on his shoulders. And it's a difficult thing to navigate, especially at a young age. I think you have to have a particular disposition or have some sort of defense mechanism in order to survive that type of experience. And whenever I see a new young artist, someone who's young and they've become famous overnight, my initial reaction is always concern. I always think, God, I hope they make it. I hope they can push through this. I hope they can do it. Someone like Billie Eilish, I love Billie so much. She's got such a beautiful family. When she started becoming the biggest artist in the world, my initial reaction was concern. But the fact that she was so close to her family and she has such a beautiful, strong family, I thought, well, she's going to make it because she has this loving family.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, look, finally, I mean, it seems I won't probably be able to get on to too much about Foo Fighters and your loving family, too, which is the biggest part and most important part of your life. I just want to say, to get away from all of the madness of what was going on and Kurt and the heroin, and you thought he died when you got a phone call, which we all did, actually, in Rome. And then 30 days later, he did. You go on about that you had to get away and you've been to a place that you always adored, a place of serenity and natural beauty. I'm trying to read this on my mobile phone here. It's not easy. Where I hope to find some healing from my broken life at home. And basically it was the Ring of Kerry, and you've gone back, you went to the Ring of Kerry, having, you were going to play somewhere in London, I think it was your last English gig ever, actually, with Nirvana, and then you decided to go from Dublin to Dingle, and just to get away from everything because of your mother's roots, etc. Just tell me about what Kerry did to you. I know, by the way, yeah, what Kerry did to you was, you meet a guy hitching, he's wearing a Nirvana t-shirt, that freaked you so much you went off and formed Foo Fighters. But anyway, just tell me about coming to Dingle.
Well, okay, so you're right. Before the 1992 Reading Festival, I brought my mother to Ireland for the first time, and she has Irish heritage. And so she, my sister, and I just rented a car, drove around from Dublin to Dingle. We were staying in a little bed and breakfast. It was great. It was beautiful. It was a bonding experience for the three of us. And I know that my mother fell in love with the country. So I'd always loved that part of the world. And just the beauty and the serenity and how you feel, you know, disconnected from the rest of the world when you're in that place. So when Nirvana ended, I really did some soul searching. I didn't know what to do. Do I continue playing music? Do I continue being a drummer? What do I do with my life? And I thought, well, the one place I'm going to be able to sort it all out is back at the Ring of Kerry. And so I flew over. I drove out to that part of the country. And one day I'm driving and I see a hitchhiker. And I think, well, I'll pick him up. It's raining. And as I got closer, I noticed that he had a Kurt Cobain t-shirt on. So here I was in the middle of nowhere, and I have Kurt staring back at me. And I thought, this is a sign. This means it's time to move on. I have to do something. I can't be stuck in this place for the rest of my life. And so I went home and immediately recorded the Foo Fighters music.
Fantastic. And then the rest is in the book. It's all there. Dave, it's been a real pleasure. It's a fantastic book, a story so well told. And I think we'll get a part two in 20 years' time. Thanks so much, Dave.
Good man. Thanks, Dave. Take care, man.
Thanks a million. Bye. Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.